Oh, happy birthday, Tim. Happy birthday, son. When Tim was a freshman, just finished his freshman year, Patty and I took out our first ministry team, and Tim was the bass on that team, and so the members called us Mom and Dad all summer long, and so we go way, way back, about 5 or 6 years. Okay, we're on session 4 tonight. Do we have to take him along? This lesson title looks like a child's perspective of having the responsibility of an afternoon of being his little brother's keeper. And sometimes we, you know, as children, our moms would ask us to do an errand or something and say, "Now take your little brother." And we would say, "Do I have to take him along?" This kind of thing. Well, of course, the answer in all of those cases with Mom and Dad was, yes, you have to take him along and be nice to him and don't hurt him, you know, that kind of thing. Sometimes people feel that way about God. And sometimes we even say that about God in ways we don't think are irreverent, but we'll look at some of those tonight. And the point of the message tonight is if you don't take him along, you aren't going either. And that's an important lesson from Ecclesiastes. We're on Discourse 1 yet, The Secret of Pleasure. And that's a continuation of last night. And we looked at Solomon's misery, great emptiness as he explored life. He looked at the emptiness of it and the great energy that was being expended, all seeming to still end up with an empty canvas. And Solomon's mission of going out and trying to find out through all of these areas, through his parties and his shopping and his building enterprises and all of these adventures. We might say today that he was into extreme stuff. He was into extreme shopping. Nobody had this many horses. He had palaces that probably would make Saddam Hussein blush. He was into extreme building. He was into extreme eating. Not that he overate, probably, but he didn't withhold any delicacy. And that's often the sign of someone whose heart is despairing. And I think, as I mentioned in Created for His Glory in chapter 1, I think one of the evidences of the extreme the growing despair in our culture is its saturation or its propensity for extreme things. All these kinds of things to dull are anesthesia of one type or another to dull the pain of an empty life. And after he goes on this mission, labored expending wealth and exploring wisdom and all these things. And we expect him to come up after all of these things. We expect him. He's driving home with precise hammer-like blows his point that life apart from God is futile. And we brace ourselves for a command to stop having fun. But he doesn't do that. Instead, he says, I want you to enjoy. You are here to enjoy what God has given you. And it's kind of like sometimes we have the idea God is looking down over heaven, the battlements of heaven, and saying, Berg, you down there, are you having fun? And we say, oh, yes, Lord, a great time. Well, then cut it out. No, that's not his attitude at all. And Solomon's message we find in verses 24 to 26 of chapter 2, and I've put here Kaiser's translation of this because I think it's much more clear for us than our authorized version. Verse 24, this is right in your notes. Here's the conclusion of this first search, this first discourse. There is not a good inherent in man that he should be able to eat, drink, or to get satisfaction from his work. He said, one of the things I've realized from all of this is that there is not anything inherent in man to have ability to get enjoyment from all of these things he pursues. And he said, even this, I realized, was from the hand of God. Any enjoyment he has is from the hand of God. Verse 25, apart from him, Who can eat and who can have enjoyment? That's a rhetorical question, and the answer is no one. I don't think I said this here, but have you ever heard that statement? What kind of an idiot would ask a rhetorical question? Well, Solomon is asking a rhetorical question here. He's saying, apart from him, who can eat and who can have enjoyment? And the answer is no one. In verse 26, for to the man who pleases him, and we'll find out what pleases God in a few minutes, he gives, these are gifts, he gives wisdom and knowledge and joy. But to the sinner, or the one who is ignoring God, he gives the work of gathering and heaping up in order to give it to the one who pleases God. This also is a vanity and a chasing after wind. And this theme that he just mentions in this message right here, this conclusion, comes at in just a little different words, but comes at the conclusion of every one of these four discourses. This is why I believe there are four discourses. He gives the same kind of invitation and conclusion at the end of each one of these. In fact, let's just take a peek at them real quickly. Turn over to chapter 3. And I want you to notice this theme in verse 13. This is part of the... this isn't one of the conclusions, but verse 13, and also that every man should eat and drink and enjoy the good of all his labor. Now, he's not a hedonist here. He says God really wants us to enjoy what he gives. It is the gift of God, but all of this enjoyment is a gift. Would you look over chapter 5, verse 19? This is in the conclusion to discourse 2 in verse 19. And we're going to spend more time on this a little bit later, but he says, every man also to whom God hath given riches and wealth and hath given him power to eat thereof and to take his portion and it's implied here, and given to rejoice in his labor. This is the gift of God. So here is the point here. We're going to come back to this later. But here God says, I have given to, Solomon says, I see what's happening here. God has given to some people a gift of riches, but he hasn't given them the gift of rejoicing. And did you know that the rejoicing doesn't come automatically with the riches? That's a separate gift. Whether you enjoy something or not is a separate gift from the gift itself. Am I making sense? There are people that God gives nothing as far as riches is concerned, but gives them a gift of rejoicing, and they're wonderfully happy with nothing. And some people stand back and say, I don't understand what's going on. Because God has given them the gift of rejoicing. Now, other people that have a gift of riches God has given with them, but for some reason, because of what he wants to teach them, he's withheld the gift of rejoicing, and there is no rejoicing in their gift. And that's what Solomon is finding out here as we go through this. He said, I had all of the riches, but I didn't have any of the enjoyment of it. Why? Because those are two separate gifts. And Solomon said, I learned this, even this, the gift of rejoicing is a gift. Or the rejoicing is a gift, just like the riches are a gift. That's an important thing we're going to come back to. And that brings us to the in this message of his book here, that brings us to the equation of enjoyment. This is what I call the equation of enjoyment, or the secret of pleasure. Now, we'll do a little math here. I am mathematically challenged. I can get it wrong even with a four-function calculator. And barely understand that. But I can understand. Here's a little expression here. We have 25 plus 15 plus 40 plus 8 inside parentheses. And what that means in expressions like that is that you're supposed to do that math before you do the next component of the math. And I don't even know what I'm talking about, but that's what I remember from I think it was, do we call this algebra? Is this what that is? I'm not into higher level math. But anyway, I understand this, that no matter what you can accumulate on your side of it, anything multiplied by zero is still zero. I do remember that. Now, what God is, and on the other hand, if you have something very small, like 2 plus 3 on this side of it, on the multiplicand side of it, and you multiply that by 50, you have 250. Now, the thing I'm trying to illustrate by this, and this really is a paradox that I'm illustrating anything by math. because that's a paradox. If you take this, let's say that the top part there, the 25 plus 15 by plus 40 plus 8, let's say that represents different components of your life. Things that you try to get on your side of the equation. Maybe the 25 is the energy that you expend in your job or in your ministry. And let's say, and we're unbalanced on this, but let's say that the 15 is the amount of energy that you spend in your friendships and relationships in life, trying to get those in order. And the 10, let's say that is the time that you spend and the energy that you spend on your health, trying to get that together. And the 40, because things aren't going really well, the 40 is the time and the energy you spend pursuing entertainment, because the rest of it is the pits. And then 8 might be the time and energy you spend in spiritual matters, going to church and perhaps trying to read your Bible on a fairly regular basis, and once in a while trying to follow a prayer list with God and some things like that. Now, what I'm trying to illustrate here is that all of us think, or we naturally think, that our real enjoyment in life comes when we have all of that stuff together on our side of the equation. But you know what? That's not the critical part of the equation. The critical part of the equation is what God does with all of that. And if He chooses to multiply all of that by zero, it still is zero. There is no enjoyment in it. On the other hand, let's say that for some reason you're very, very limited. Let's say that you're in a it doesn't even have to be a later part of life, but you can have a stroke. And we have some examples here. We have Luke Gribbick here, because of what happened with him and the oxygen not getting to his brain and the limitations that came. And we all rejoice when Luke begins to walk and with his walker here and take those steps. And it's a thrilling thing for us. How many things can he put on his side of the equation right now? Maybe 2 and maybe 3, 2 plus 3. You know what? If God decides to give him a heart of rejoicing, Luke can have a heart of rejoicing that some of the rest of us might never have, trying to accumulate everything on our end. And what I'm trying to illustrate here, and what Solomon is trying to drive home here, is that God is the most crucial part of the equation, not what you can do. And really, we're back to the main theme of the scripture of dependence. But we rebel against that because we think, well, I've got to do something, or I can do something, or this is what's frustrating. The reason I don't have any enjoyment is because I don't have 25 over here on this thing, and I don't have 40 over here, and I don't have 8 over here, and I've got to get those before I have enjoyment. And Solomon would say, you're a fool. Because you're ignoring the most significant part of the equation, and that's the multiplier. Who takes your multiplicand and makes something out of it, or makes nothing out of it. And the lessons for us here are numerous. You know what's really exciting about this? I mean, this can be a rebuke to us if we're trying to accumulate everything on that side. But on the other hand, we can begin to look at our limitations like we're going to look at tonight in this session. And take great hope, because God doesn't need a lot to work with. I mean, if He wants somebody to talk, He can make donkeys talk. He doesn't need much. He makes all of those worlds that we looked at last night. We looked at that galaxy of the Milky Way last night. What did He make that out of? Nothing. Why? Because you know what that proves? He's the most significant part of the equation. He can take nothing and multiply it into something that appears to us infinite. It's not infinite, but it's certainly big. And he comes to Moses, and Moses says, I can't do this. And how am I going to tell these people what to do? And God says, what's that in your hand? And he says, a stick. And God says, throw it on the ground. And you know what God does? He makes it a snake.
God doesn't need a lot to work with. He wants to make snakes, he can make them out of sticks. You try that. You and I can't make donkeys talk. We can't even get our cat to come in at night.
God has amazing ability. You know what that is? You know what that means for us folks? That ought to generate a lot of hope. I'm just a donkey and I can't talk much. Oh, that's all right. Because there's a God in heaven that can do amazing things with donkeys. That's why I said in Change Into His Image, the potential doesn't lie in any of in us. The potential always is in God. We don't look at pass a field of donkeys. Well, let me back up a little bit. Sometimes I hear preachers come to Bob Jones and they preach in chapel and they look out over this mass of students and they see 6,000 people out here and they say, what amazing potential. This isn't, I know what they're saying, but the potential isn't here. The potential's in God. You don't look out a whole field of donkeys and say, my, that's a potential for a lot of preachers. Well, could become a lot of preachers because God can do that. The potential isn't in the donkey. The potential is in the God who does something with the donkey. You don't look at a whole bunch of sticks out here in the woods around us on a cleanup day and say, boy, there's a potential for a lot of snakes out here. Well, there is if God wants to make snakes out of those sticks. But the potential is not in those sticks. It's in God. And the enjoyment and the potential for our lives, folks, has nothing to do with what we accumulate. It has everything to do with who He is and where we are, where we stand before Him at the moment. And Solomon is driving that home. God can take and give you much. What did He do with Israel? They said, we're tired of manna. We want quail. So God says, all right, here, take the quail. And they got quail coming out their ears. And they start stuffing it in their mouths. And what does God do for the enjoyment factor? He turns it putrid in their mouths. Just because you have the quail doesn't mean you can enjoy the quail if God turns it sour in your mouth. What I'm trying to illustrate, folks, is that He is the only one in charge of the enjoyment factor in life. Enjoyment factor is not found in any part of the creation. It's found only in the Creator. And if you don't take Him along, you can't enjoy the quail. It will turn sour in your mouth. Nebuchadnezzar had everything the world could offer. And God took away the enjoyment factor, and the only thing he could enjoy was eating grass like an ox. God controls the enjoyment factor of the equation. It's not found in anything you and I can accumulate or work on or throw our energy at in this earth. That comes out very clearly in Luke chapter 12. In fact, turn over there and let's see what Jesus himself said about this in another passage. And you've heard this passage many times and said, well, this doesn't apply to me. It applies to all of us. Because all of us have things we think we have to have in our barns to make life work. Or we have temptations to that. Luke chapter 12, verse 15. And he said unto them, take heed and beware of covetousness. What is that? That is the desire for something more. Remember how the way down starts? We talked about that in that diagram. The way down, it starts with dissatisfaction. What does Jesus say? Beware of covetousness, thinking you have to have something more. For a man's life consisteth not in the abundance of the things which he possesseth. You say, well, I don't have a lot of possessions. What are you trying to accumulate? Acceptance of your friends, achievement in this or that. And it may be an accumulation of possessions. It may be, and you say, well, I don't have a lot of money. But the greed can be just in, if I had it, this is what I would be doing with it. I have to have this, or I really want that. I can't be happy without this. Verse 16, and he spake a parable unto them, saying, the ground of a certain rich man brought forth plentifully, and he thought within himself, saying, what shall I do, because I have no room where to bestow my fruits? And he said, this will I do, I will pull down my barns and build greater, and there will I bestow all my fruits and my goods. He's accumulating everything he can in his part of the equation. And I will say to my soul, soul, thou hast much goods laid up for many years. Take thine ease, eat, drink, and be merry. Now, listen what's happening here. He's saying, when I get my barns full, then my heart can rest, and I can say, now I can take my ease. When I get all of this stuff on my part of the equation, then I can take my ease. Now, most of us don't have a lot of wealth. And so we may say, well, you know, this doesn't apply to me. You know, I know I'm never going to get it. But we're trying to accumulate other stuff. We're trying to get the acceptance of other people. We're trying to get the spotlight in front of other people. Or we're trying to get the approval of other people. We're trying to get the 4.0 or the first chair or the this award or that award. Or whatever it is we think we have to make life work. Or we think I have to have more independence. I have to have bigger barns of independence. I'm too tied down with mom and dad, or too tied down in this marriage, and I have to have more independence, something more on my side of the equation. Or maybe we have something really nice and we think, I've got to keep this. I've got it in my barn now. The problem is you get all this stuff in your barns thinking that that's going to make you secure, and then you got to spend a lot of time and anxiety watching to make sure the barns don't burn down. So you were anxious while you were getting it. Now you got it. Now you're anxious that it's going to go away. Maybe you got the family. Maybe you got the husband you wanted. Maybe you got the wife you wanted. Maybe you got the approval you wanted. Now you're anxious that somehow you're going to lose it. In verse 20, but God said unto him, thou fool, this night thy soul shall be required of thee. Then shall be whoso shall those things be which thou hast provided. And here's why he calls him a fool. So is he. He said, I'm talking about the one that layeth up treasure for himself and is not rich toward God. Now, whether it's a relationship you're trying to accumulate, or maybe you say, well, I don't need a lot of them. I just want one. I'd be happy to have a barn with just one relationship in it. But whatever it is, when we're trying to accumulate that with the thought that this is what's going to let my soul take its ease and rest, we're focusing on the wrong part of the equation. We're trying to collect. And by the way, folks, this is the essence of worldliness. Most of us would not consider ourselves worldly because we don't go around spiking our hair in different colors and putting body piercings in every part that can hold a body piercing. We say, well, of course I'm not worldly. You know, I don't dress that way. That's a very little of what worldliness is. Worldliness is living as if satisfaction comes from things in this world. And we're out collecting experiences or achievements or stuff or standards, or friends. We say, well, you know, if I get all the standards right. And there's nothing wrong with friends, and there's nothing wrong with standards, as long as we don't think it's the standards that make life secure. I mean, this is what the Pharisees were doing. They were collecting standards. Now, they're not the rebels of those days, folks. The rebels were the Sadducees. They were the fundamentalists. The Pharisees were the fundamentalists of their day, the one who were trying to do right, but afraid that they might mess up. And so they set up this standard and this standard and this standard. If I keep all the standards, then I'll be safe. And they had barns full of standards, thinking that when they got the barns full, they could take their ease and rest. Is there anything wrong with standards? No. Unless you think somehow that's the thing that's going to make you safe. It might help your testimony or so forth. But anyway, they collected so many, it was a burden to them and it was a burden to anybody else. And we look at them with disgust and say, I would never do that. And yet there's some of us in our personal life, we're very proud of that. We don't smoke, we don't drink, we don't chew, we don't go with those who do. And we got it all down right. We go to the right church, we sing the right music,
We've got all our barns full with the right standards, and when everything is right, we can take our ease. And we might, and I'm not even saying we're irreligious about it, we're even asking God to help us get that friend that we think we have to have in that barn. We're asking God to help us get the stuff we think we have to make life work. We're even asking God to help us get all the standards right. But if our reason for all of those things is so that then we can feel safe, it's the wrong motive for it. And He's not going to help us with it. He's not going to help us fill our barns with stuff so we can feel safe. He's not going to help us fill our barns with all the right standards so that we can feel safe. He's not going to help us with any of those things. We say, well, I pray to God and ask Him to help me. He's not going to help. He's not going to answer a prayer of helping us do the wrong thing. I'm not saying the standards are wrong or the friends are wrong or the money is wrong or anything, but it's what place it has in our life and what we're looking to it to do for us. And Solomon is saying, I spent my life collecting all that stuff. And why don't we say, well, I really don't need that friend. I really don't need all of this acclaim, and I really don't need all of that. You know, it's just something I'd like to have, but I really don't need it. Well, then why are we so agitated when it doesn't happen? We really are looking to it. In this way, you know, adults, isn't this what we do with our kids? You know, I remember Kirsten coming home one day, saying, Daddy, there's a boy in my class. This is fifth or sixth grade. And, you know, everybody in our class, you know, a lot of them kind of like to go with somebody. You know, and I know there's this boy because I talked to my friend who talked to him. And I know that he would like to go with me if I would like to go with him. And can I go with him? And we sat down, we talked about that. And I said, honey, you know, do you like this boy? She said, yes. And I said, you know, I don't mind that you like this boy. And but I said, you can't make any commitment that you are his boy. You can't go with him. And she said, well, Dad, and this is what, isn't this what we do with parents? As parents. And so, well, Dad, it's not that big of a thing. And, you know, and I said, well, honey, if it's not that big of a thing, then you won't mind if you don't do it, right? You know, and they feel like they have been just hammered by a district attorney. An entrapment, you know, this kind of thing. But folks, isn't that true? We say, well, you know, I really don't need this stuff. Well, then try taking it away. And let's see how agitated we get. And how anxious we get. It shows we were looking to our side of the multiplicand to make things work. By the way, we get, you know, today we hear things about obsessive compulsive behavior and about bizarre behavior. And we look at people who do strange things and we think, boy, you know, that's really weird. You know, every one of those people are doing what they're doing for a very logical reason to them. Let me give you an illustration. Let's say we go over to the African continent or South American continent, and we go out into the jungle, and we find a tribesman out there who has a naturalism religion, a pagan religion, and the thing that makes him feel safe every day is at 10 o'clock in the morning and 2 o'clock in the afternoon. He goes out into his chicken coop and gets a chicken and cuts its head off and sprinkles the blood around his hut. And every time he finishes doing that, he feels really safe. And then he starts, you know, he does that at 10 o'clock in the morning. About 2 o'clock in the afternoon, he's starting to get a little agitated because I got to make sure that I've got everything handled just right. And as soon as he cuts the head off and sprinkles the blood around the hut, he breathes a sigh of relief and everything is fine. And the evil spirits are warded off until 10 o'clock tomorrow morning when he's got to do this again. Now we say, well, of course I understand that. Now, you try that in your neighborhood. You know, you just got a brand new car, and you just want to make sure nothing happens to it on the road or in the garage. And so every day at 10 o'clock and 2 o'clock, you cut off the head of a chicken and sprinkle blood around the house, around the garage. And see if people don't really wonder what is going on. You know, because in our context here, that looks really bizarre. You know, in the context over there, it makes perfect sense with their religion, with their belief system,
And if your belief system was that same thing here, it would make perfect sense to you to do the same thing. The reason people get into compulsive behavior is because it gives them a sense of relief right after they do it. It makes perfect sense to them. But then, just like the chicken blood, it soaks into the ground and it's got to be done again. And the only reason it gives any sense of relief is because we have chosen to believe that will help. And whether I've talked with parents who've had little children, a 7-year-old girl who, when she came into any room, had to drag her foot around the shoe molding around the room before she could play in that room. Another one, she had to turn 3 times in the doorway before she would leave that room to make sure that she. You know, we'd say, well, you know, that's kind of that's bizarre behavior. That is just the superstitious behavior of the human heart, who's come up with his own way of trying to feel safe. And it does give an immediate sense of relief, because we believe that it would. Am I making sense? Let's not look at people's behavior and say, well, you know, that's really bizarre. There's a very good reason in their belief system of why they're doing what they're doing. And it is helping them momentarily. And that's what happens when we start looking toward things in our side of the equation and thinking they're the most important thing. And we go back to the human dilemma, or let's see, the qualification for enjoyment here, Ecclesiastes 2:11, is to the man who pleases him, he gives wisdom and knowledge and joy. So here are the components for genuine satisfaction. If you really want to be satisfied, you have to have wisdom, and you have to have the knowledge of God, which is a part of wisdom, and you have to have joy. Now, where do you get those? You can only get those from God. And if you're leaving, if you're not taking Him along, then you can't have these things that produce genuine satisfaction in life. What we ought to be doing is asking ourselves, God, what is so wrong with my heart right now that it is so dissatisfied? My heart is anxious about this thing or that thing. What is so wrong with my heart that I don't have wisdom and knowledge and joy right now? Because it is a gift He is wanting to give us. Look at this revelation. Oh, excuse me. This is the way down again. This is the dissatisfaction that pushes us into the anxiety. That's where the obsessions come, and the compulsions, and all of the worry, and all of the anxiety issues come from people who are dissatisfied with the way things are, and they've made up their mind they have to have something else. And it's not happening. Or they've got it, and now they've got to make sure they keep it. Revelation 4:11 tells us, Thou art worthy, O Lord, to receive glory and honor and power, for Thou hast created all things, and for Thy pleasure they are and were created. You know why we were created? Well, of course, to accumulate stuff. No, for the pleasure of our God. You ever, when you're having your devotions in the morning or several times throughout the day, say, God, would you just help me to be a blessing to you today? Because that's what we're created to do, is be a blessing to God for His pleasure. Sometimes I say, God, I know you don't take breaks and you don't need breaks, but just in my human way of thinking about it, if you need to take a break today, and He wants some enjoyment out of whatever you're doing, and He doesn't need enjoyment outside of Himself. But I'm speaking as a human here. Lord, I want to be the kind of person today that if you wanted a break and just wanted to enjoy something, that you could look down and I would just bring you some pleasure because of the way I'm looking to you to help. That brings Him pleasure. You know, I say, well, what do I have to give God that brings Him pleasure? I'm starting to learn some of these things in a different way. We have a grandson who's 14 months old. And you know what? He contributes nothing to the productivity of life. In fact, he is a genuine taker. And the last several days, he's been stricken with a very severe bout of diarrhea. And I'm not trying to be gross here, but he's high maintenance right now. Not contributing a lot. But you know what? It's just a joy to have him around. And you know what? We don't contribute anything to God's day. We're like a bunch of toddlers with diarrhea. Really, we are. You know, if you think somehow, you know, God's probably really happy to have me around. There is less distance between that toddler and me than there is between me and God. I mean, there's enormous distance between the kind of being He is and what I am down here. And just being here and looking up to Him, you know, I mean, when Bobby just runs to you and smiles, when he just recognizes you and runs to you, it just kind of, you know, you think, oh, this is kind of neat. And you know what? When God sees one of us just running to Him and recognizing Him and saying, God, my Father, it pleases Him to no end. And that's why we're created. And you know what? The person who is in a habit of doing that gets a gift of joy from God. That's the only way you can have joy. It's the only way you can have rejoicing. It's not in any of the stuff you can accumulate on your side of the equation. He says it this way in Matthew 6:33, but seek ye first the kingdom of God, the things of God and His righteousness, and all these things shall be added unto you. You know, we kind of understand this a little bit as you know, when we're first married or when we're thinking about marriage, don't we think, you know, we don't need anything. We just need each other. You know, we can live in this apartment. We don't have to have any furniture. We can sit on boxes. You know, we'll put a tablecloth over a bigger box and we'll just, I mean, we don't need anything. We just need each other. And you know what? That's true. And then somehow all the other stuff gets in the way and we think we've got to have this and we've got to have that and all this kind of thing. And pretty soon the people aren't the part of the equation that is so important. And that's exactly what happens with God and us. Look at some of the supporting passages down here. Other passages of Scripture that teach the same thing. Haggai 1, 6 to 7. You have sown much and bring in little. Ye eat, but you have not enough. Ye drink, but you are not filled with drink. Ye clothe you, but there is none warm. And he that earneth wages to put it into a bag with holes. Thus saith the Lord of hosts, consider your ways. Those of us who have been around here for a while, remember the haunting phrase of Pastor Dixon after preaching on this message. Remember that? How many remember that? Say it with me. Into a bag, into a bag, into a bag with holes. Into a bag, into a bag, into a bag with holes. And that's what God is saying here. You leave God out of this equation, all you can do is put all that stuff in a bag with holes in it. Look at John 15. Our Lord said this, abide in me and I in you. As the branch cannot, doesn't say we'll have a hard time, it says he cannot bear fruit of itself. Except it abide in the vine, no more can ye except ye abide in me. And we look at that and say, well, yeah, I understand that. If I'm going to be a soul winner, I can't be a soul winner without being in fellowship with God. For right now, I'm not in fellowship with God, and soul winning isn't a big thing for me. And I know I can't do that. I recognize that. He's not just talking about bearing fruit of soul winning. He's talking about the fruit of joy, the fruit of peace, the fruit of goodness. You can't have any of those without abiding in God. They're fruit of the Spirit. He says, I am the vine and you're the branches. He that abideth in me and I in him, the same bringeth forth much fruit. For without me ye can do nothing. Psalm 4:7, David said, Thou, you, God, you have put gladness in my heart. It's a gift from you. You have put the gladness in my heart more than in the time that their corn and their wine increased. They have all their corn and they have all their wine and their wine presses are full and their barns are full, but they don't have the joy that I have because I have you. Now ask yourself, do I really believe that? Or do I really think I have to have the wine presses full and the barns full? Because if you do,
you'll be goaded a lot in life. Look at Proverbs 14. The house of the wicked shall be overthrown, but the tabernacle of the upright shall flourish. There is a way which seemeth right unto a man. He thinks he has to have these things, but the end thereof are the ways of death. Even in laughter, the heart is sorrowful. And the end of that mirth is heaviness. The backslider in heart shall be filled with his own ways. And a good man shall be satisfied from himself or with the results of his ways. The fellowship with God. Psalm 127:1, except the Lord, his part of the equation, build the house, they labor in vain that build it, except the Lord keep the city, the watchman waketh but in vain. Now, please understand what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that wealth is evil. No, I'm not jumping on wealth. Our friend's evil. I'm not jumping on friends. Having a friend. Is position or honor evil? No. Those are gifts from God. But none of them satisfy without God. He's the multiplier. And we have to see the humility and the dependence that has to be in our soul here if we're going to have enjoyment. Remember, the title of this discourse is The Secret of Pleasure. Solomon is teaching us that. And that humility and that distinctive and that dependency is instinctive to a person who really is seeing God. In John 20:27-28, then saith he to Thomas, reach hither thy finger and behold my hands, and reach hither thy hand and thrust it in my side, and be not faithless but believing. And Thomas answered and said unto him, my Lord and my God. What happened here? When he really saw who he was looking at, he fell on his face and said, you are the Lord. You are the God. Same thing happened with Peter in Luke 5:8. When Peter saw it, the great catch of fish, he fell down at Jesus' knees saying, depart from me, O Lord, I am a sinful man. There's that dependency. It's instinctive. The dependency and the humility is instinctive to a person who has seen God. Some of you remember in Change Into His Image, the story of the boy and the bike. That illustration wasn't written for Change Into His Image. I use it in Change Into His Image, but it was written initially for this presentation in Ecclesiastes. Because I was trying to think for these college students, how can I illustrate how much a part of the equation God is and how little we are? And so the first time I told the story of the boy and the bike was in the singles class over here in this section of the auditorium, and later on used that in Change Into His Image. Well, the BJU Press, when they were doing the videos of taping the videos of Change Into His Image, when I videotaped the lecture, decided to dramatize that part of it using our own homegrown actor here, Gary Moore, and his family. And because you've only seen live presentations of Change Into His Image, you haven't ever seen this, and I want to show you the video of the boy and the bike, and then we'll talk about it.
That we're not able to please him at all. And that brings us to a very, very important. The creation demands dependency. Creation demands dependency. Perhaps an illustration will help us understand this a little bit better. I like to call this parable a boy and a bike. And six-year-old Johnny comes in the living room, sees Dad, and he says,
Dad, I'm six now, and I think I can ride a bike. I want to buy a bike.
Well, son, bikes cost a lot of money. How are you going to pay for a bike?
You know, I got my quarter.
Well, where'd you get the quarter?
You know, every week I help you wash the car, and you give me a quarter. And I saved it this week because I wanted to buy a bike.
I can see you're pretty serious about that bike if you're not spending it on gum and candy. Well, tell you what, you go get your quarter, and let's go get in the car, and let's go find a bike.
So they shop around a couple of stores, and And finally, they come to the store and looking around, and Johnny sees a bike he wants to see.
This one right here. This is the bike. I dream about this bike. I love this bike. And Dad, I got my quarter.
Dad looks at the price tag on the bike and sees that with tax, it's going to come to $100 even, which is a far cry from a quarter. And he says,
well, all right, son. Just wheel that bike up to the counter and let's pay the clerk.
So Johnny wheels the bike up to the counter, slams his quarter down on the counter, and says,
I want to buy this bike.
Son, that is a really good choice. That's a good choice.
Tell you what, son. You take this bike and wheel it out front and wait for me out there. I need to talk to this lady.
So Dad writes out a check for $99.75. He walks outside and they load the bike up in the car. And after they get in the car, Dad turns to Johnny and says,
I want to tell you something, Johnny. I am really proud of you today because every other week you spent your quarter on something that wouldn't last. And this week you saved it for something that would last a long time. I can tell you're growing up. I'm really proud of you.
And they get home and unload the bike. He runs in the house.
Mom, come look on my bike. Mom, I bought it with my own quarter.
Wow, what a great bike. Honey, I love it.
Now we can laugh at Johnny's naivete. He really thought he bought the bike when in reality his dad bought the bike.
One of the quotes from one of the commentaries is next in your notes. The purpose of life cannot be found in any one of the good things found in the world. All the things we call the goods of life, health, riches, possessions, position, sensual pleasures, honors, and prestige slip through man's hands unless they are received as a gift from God and until God gives man the ability to enjoy them and obtain satisfaction from them. A relationship is front and center here. Relationship with God Himself. Conclusion. Is your goal your enjoyment or God's enjoyment? Are you out today for your enjoyment or are you trying to be a blessing to God today? Are you expecting to get from life's components what only your Creator can give you? Do you really think you can buy the bike without taking Him along? When you experience despair, unfulfillment, and restlessness, is it really possible for you to find enjoyment by increasing experiences and possessions? Or do you need to stop and consider that perhaps your emptiness is because God is not in your equation? Do you depend upon Him only to help you add things to your side of the equation? Or do you depend upon Him to add the enjoyment to what you already have? That last statement is crucial, folks. Do you depend upon Him only to help you add things to your side of the equation? Oh, God, give me this relationship. Oh, God, give me this stuff. Oh, God, help me to keep this stuff. Oh, God, give me this position. Oh, God, pay up our bills. Are we only asking God to help us fill our side of the equation? Or do you depend upon Him to add the enjoyment to what you already have? The poor health you already have. The poor marriage you already have. The sorrows that are already into your life through your fault or other people's fault. The joy won't come when finally all of that stuff is resolved. That would be a wonderful thing if many of those things were resolved or if our health was restored. But I can have joy in the middle of all of this if I have the pleasure of God, the gift of God. Despair is God's goad to get us moving to dependency. You have to take Him along. Your quarter won't buy the bike. As I mentioned last night, by the way, suicide is a logical conclusion for a person not seeing God in the center of this. I had a student in my office several years back, and he was a business student, bright fella, but his productivity and his grades was going downhill, and And he was becoming a thorn in the flesh to everybody he lived with. And his relationships were degenerating. And he'd been talking to his roommates, well, maybe everybody would be better off without me around, and this kind of thinking. So I said, well, I want to talk to him. So I talked to him, and we talked about the despair he was experiencing. And I said, tell me what it is you think you have to have. What is your goal? He said, well, my goal, I want to be like Donald Trump. And I said, what do you mean like Donald Trump? You know, to have all this stuff. And I said, no wonder you want to commit suicide. I said that jokingly, but I said, honestly, I said it jokingly that way, but I said, honestly, I don't blame you for wanting to take your life. That is not worth living for. Life isn't worth living that way. You've come to the right conclusion. You have the wrong solution. I want to leave you in this session with this quote from Martin Lloyd-Jones. Worldliness, and as I said, most of us wouldn't consider ourselves worldly. But there is a worldly streak in every one of us in the sinful nature. Worldliness is ultimately anything that tries to make us feel satisfied without fellowship and communion with God. Lord Jesus, give us an understanding of these things. Open our eyes to your truth, I pray in your name. Amen.